Welcome to the Learning Scientist Podcast, a podcast for teachers, students, and parents about evidence-based practice and learning.
All right. Welcome back to another episode of the Learning Scientist Podcast. I'm very excited to be joined today by my new friend, Sean McCormick. Sean does a lot of work with executive functioning. And so today we're going to have a really nice conversation about what that really means and how executive functioning is important both for kind of academic performance, but especially for individuals who are kind of in the special education population. So I'm excited to dig into this. So for a little background, Sean is an AmeriCorps and Teach for America alum, we can say, I suppose. And then he spent about 5 years working in public education in the Buffalo and Bay areas. And now he works as an executive functioning coach. So we'll talk a little bit about that here in a bit. So welcome, Sean. Thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Dr. Niebel, for having me as a guest. I look forward to chatting with you.
So let's just start with this general idea of executive functioning. Most of our listeners are educators, so likely they have heard of executive functioning, but we know from the research that it is not always super well defined and people might be talking about two different things. So let's just talk about your framework for executive functioning so that folks know what we are really talking about today.
So I like to start by differentiating between executive functions, things like cognitive processing, working memory, the ability to play with information, these cognitive processes that are somewhat, I would say, to some degree fixed versus executive function skills, which can be developed and worked on, like developing your ability to do long-range planning or externalizing your goals. I've worked with a lot of parents and educators who are like, what is it? So the first thing I usually say is, it's your ability to have a long-term goal or, you know, some type of larger goal, and then to use your skills and abilities to find a way to reach that goal. And so then they say, well, what are the skills? And I say, I came up with this acronym called POSITIVE to explain it, because there's so many potential skills. But the ones that I've primarily noticed are essential for students to reach their goals are what I call positive skills. So planning, organization, self-awareness / self-management, inhibition, time management, initiation of challenging tasks, visualizing outcomes, and evaluating priorities. So I like to say, like, those are probably some of the main ones. Of course, there's other little ones here and there. But if you can kind of like start to develop those, you're gonna do better on your kind of big goals and executive tasks.
So let me ask you a question. To me, as a cognitive psychologist, not coming from education world where executive functioning is discussed more frequently, it sounds to me like what you are saying is we have working memory. And that is basically what executive functioning is. And then separate from that, we have what the things you can do with working memory. Does that ring true, or are they separate but related?
Yeah, I would expand the definition of executive functioning to say more than working memory. I'd say cognitive flexibility. And I know that you and the learning scientist team have real depth of knowledge around memory. So I'm sure there's things I'm going to learn here too. But my understanding, especially after working with a lot of students with autism and ADHD, is that cognitive flexibility piece, like being able to, like, you know, pick up on nonverbal cues or, you know, there's a lot of other factors. It's kind of, one way I explain it is that the human brain is receiving, I think they say, about 50 million bits of information per second. But we can only cognitively process a very tiny small fraction of that. So we have to trust and rely on the skills we've developed to help us sort through all this stimulus, all this information. And so that includes memory. It includes being able to determine what's salient and what's not. And so those skills are hard to pin down perfectly because they're also different, I think, with each individual in terms of how they process stimulus. So I don't know if that helps nail it down further or expands it a bit, but that's how I see it.
Yeah. So I think I told you, I don't think the listeners are necessarily aware that I have a son with autism, and we're currently seeking evaluation for my daughter as well. And part of that is, like, one of the biggest hallmarks for both of them is that sort of like cognitive inflexibility. It's the idea of like, no, I have to finish this task before I can move on to the next one. Mm-hmm. Or I'm really like hyper focused on getting this right and not being able to pivot easily between different cognitive demands and different stimuli. So that's how I perceive that anyway, in seeing them and how they work with the world.
Right. Yeah. And would you say, to kind of toss it back to you, would you say that is like to extend that understanding, right? So if a child is incapable of transitioning to a task, which is probably like the primary goal, to be overall successful in school rather than just completing one task. If they're not able to basically manage a multiplicity of demands, is that working memory focused, or would you say that's like maybe a broader executive function kind of challenge? I'm curious how you would label it.
It's a good question, because I mean, I have always characterized that as very much working memory related, that tasks of inhibition I characterize as living in working memory a bit. But I also think, in the best way possible, we are talking theory, and like the practicality of it, I don't know that it matters, right? Whether we're just talking about working memory or we're talking about something else, because one of the things that we know from the research, again, is that training for any of like just talking about working memory training, it's not very effective unless you're really focused on the individual skills themselves, right? So the ability to transfer from one situation to another, to go from doing well on a test of working memory where you might have to memorize a bunch of numbers or something, doesn't necessarily translate well to that like cognitive flexibility that I'm talking about for my daughter who needs to stop working on math and now go to lunch, right? Those are two different things. And we don't have very good training transfer between those skills. So I think whether we're talking about working memory or we're talking about some skills that live just outside of working memory, I don't know that it functionally matters so much as it's an important theoretical conversation. Does that?
Yes. And actually, you remind me of a definition I share with educators sometimes when I present, which is, they ask, like, what is executive functioning? And one of the definitions I give is executive functioning, or using your executive function skills, is using skills that exist outside of the domain of your automatic psychological processing. So we have a lot of automaticity.
There you go.
No idea, right? Like, there's so many things we do that are habits and routines and become, you know, we don't have to think about it. But when we're presented with a scenario that lies outside of that automatic psychological processing, then that's where our executive function skills come into play, because now we have to kind of make real-time calculations of how to respond. And that's where we see kids with autism really struggle with this, even kids with ADHD. But if you can develop kind of a range of tools in your toolkit to self-regulate when those challenging scenarios come up, then you can train your executive function skills to serve you rather than reacting in the moment, which typically does not tend to produce a desired long-term result.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Okay. So, I mean, maybe we've already kind of been talking about this a bit, but can you talk a little bit more about kind of how executive functioning really translates into, I mean, a lot of what we've been saying is thinking about kind of behavioral stuff of like, oh, being able to switch from math to lunch or whatever. And of course, that's going to matter for academic performance. But correct me if I'm wrong, we have decent research showing that it's not just behavioral, that this really does translate into academic like performance and learning specifically.
100%. So I'm sure you know Dr. Adele Diamond. Some of her research, she had a paper published in 2012, I believe, which I know is outside of the 10-year scope of relative research. However, that study in 2020 was in the top 0.01% of downloaded studies or cited studies across all scientific disciplines and research. as far as I understand, but I do encourage people to fact check me on that. And so that study, it was a meta-analysis of different studies on executive functioning. And one of the things that was uncovered or determined in that study was that executive function skills are a better predictor of long-term math and reading outcomes than specific training around math and reading for early education. They did a study, and this was across like different, you know, social contexts and racial, also, you know, financial demographics. So they found that kids who developed better executive functioning or self-regulation skills were able to self-manage and have better academic outcomes in the long term. There's actually a bunch of other research from that study too around, I think they did a 30-year study around kids who were better at using their executive function skills, like around the ages of 7 to 10, I believe, and what happened 30 years later. And the kids who had been determined to have better self-regulation skills, like earned more, had better academic or, you know, like life outcomes in terms of like less divorce, less crime rates. So a lot of research, even over long periods of time, has shown that kids with better executive function skills do better academically and, you know, as far as life outcomes as well.
And I mean, that it meshes up nicely with some of the work that I used to teach this in my intro psych classes. Have you heard of the marshmallow test? Do you know what that is?
Is that the one where the little kids?
Yeah.
I have heard of it. Now I'm forgetting it, but it was like,
tell
me more about it.
Yeah, there's like a billion TikTok videos now where they like simulate this, but it's where kids were given a marshmallow and they needed to sit and not eat the marshmallow. They were told, hey, if you leave that sitting there, then when I come back, I'll give you a second one and you can have two marshmallows, mm-hmm. right? And for kids this age, that was very, very exciting. And then there are all these videos where you can sit and watch kids try not to eat a marshmallow for however many minutes, right? And there's lots and lots of follow-up research on this. And some of it is a little controversial, but overall, it's essentially that like self-regulation strategy of that like inhibition. Can you stop yourself from doing that? Which would fall under a type of executive function, right? Mm-hmm. And lots and lots of research showing that really well predicts lots of outcomes later in life, that self-regulation. I think there's a little bit of question of how much and how well these things really can be trained. So I'm going to like leave the research off to the side for a second. I kind of want to hear a little bit about your lived experience with working with kids who have some executive functioning difficulties. And admittedly, some of this is so I can take notes for my own son.
Yeah.
But how well does it work to try to, let's take that marshmallow test as the example, right? I imagine that if I was working with my son, I might be able to train him to leave the marshmallow. Like, we would have to work on it for a while. We would have to maybe put some tools in his toolbox. And I'm sure that's a lot of what the executive functioning work that you do is all about. How well would that then translate to financial literacy later, right? Like, if you hold on to your money now, then you're going to have more money later and you can buy a bigger toy, right? Very similar concept, but two different tasks. From all of my understanding, that wouldn't be very helpful, right? That he probably would not recognize that the tools that are helpful for the marshmallow task are going to be helpful for that. But talk to me a little bit about your lived experience with that.
Yeah, thanks for asking. And definitely happy to chat about strategies for parents as well as educators. So in my experience, and this is, I'm an adult with ADHD, so I have also struggled, you know, throughout life with impulsivity and doing what feels like a win in the short term, but then isn't really what I wanted in the long term. So I feel like I can really relate to a lot of the students I've supported, taught, coached. And what I found is, you know, when you think about the word executive functioning, it's the idea that someone would executively decide for themselves. So the primary strategy that I try to teach to others is we have to figure out a way for kids and learners to executively decide that the thing that is potentially the more challenging and more long-term thing is more attractive than the short-term thing, like one marshmallow, oh, but there's two marshmallows waiting if you can be a little patient, right? So the challenge as a parent or educator is, how do we help a child create a vision in their mind for something that's more attractive down the road than the thing that looks really good in the moment, but is not necessarily aligned with their long-term goals? So this is where we have to help kids kind of start to develop these skills. Now, this is very challenging, of course, because as brain research shows, our executive skills, particularly in our frontal lobe, don't fully develop until age of 27.
Yeah.
So kids are operating with very, I don't want to say weak, but very kind of, you know, developing executive skills. So this is where we, when you say train them, it's like we have to nurture them being able to identify things that are attracted to them. So, you know, taking this into a very practical context, one thing you can do as a parent or educator so that things don't feel like they're happening to the kid and then they have to rebel against it and like do the thing that's not good for them is kind of help them use strategies to help them think about more less impulsive outcomes. So one thing you can do as a parent is if you're helping your kid with your homework or as an educator, you can say something to them like, hey, before we, you know, work on anything, you know, is there anything on your mind that you'd like to discuss before we jump into work, right? And this has the effect of clearing the deck and kind of getting all the emotional things that might be on their mind off the table, right? Because that stuff is just going to, they're just going to jump into the thing that is exciting or, you know, resolves the issue real quick if you don't resolve some of the emotional challenge. And I've come up with this methodology I call the PEMDAS order of operations for helping kids with executive function challenges. And P stands for prioritize a secure connection first, right? Because if you don't prioritize that secure connection, then it's really difficult to make headway towards goals that require a bit more of logic and less of the emotional response. So once you've prioritized that secure connection, you've established some rapport, then you can move into E, which is establishing SMART goals. And so the way you can do this without making it feel like it's happening to the kid, so this could be good for kids with PDA or pathological demand avoidance, is start with a question like this. Hey, you know, we've got a 45-minute class period, or we got 30 minutes here, right, to work on your homework before we move on to the next, you know, phase of the day. Like, if we only did one thing that would make this time feel really meaningful and valuable for you, what would we accomplish together? Like, what could I help you with? So this puts them in the driver's seat, in the executive seat, so that they can make a determination about what is going to be the best use of their time. Now, there may be scenarios where kids are like wanting to do something that is very like inconsequential or unnecessary. And so you have to, you know, evaluate for that. But typically kids know if they have some time to process what like they're expected to do. They don't, I operate off the assumption that kids want to be successful. They want to please their teachers, their parents, their adults, but oftentimes they just don't have the frameworks and the time to do it. And so they're reacting and responding. So if you put them in the driver's seat with, hey, what would we accomplish together to make this feel like the best use of your time ever? They can usually identify the thing that they're getting pressured by the external forces to complete. So that's kind of, I would say, one of the first steps you can take as an educator or parent to help students executively identify the most important tasks and make progress towards their bigger goals.
That's so great. I literally am taking notes right now. This is fantastic.
Okay. I'm glad it feels helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. So as a, you know, parent of a child with autism, thank you. This has been a very, very effective podcast for me.
Yeah, good.
No, this is great. Okay. We've been talking, and you're a special education teacher, so you've worked primarily with students in that population. Do you think that we should be paying attention to this in all students? I mean, is this something that primarily benefits students who have difficulties with executive functioning, or, as you said, brains aren't fully developed anyway? So is this really something that is going to naturally develop for most kiddos, or do we really need to be paying attention to this and putting some effort into trying to develop this executive functioning toolbox for everyone? Is there anybody who's going to get hurt by it, I guess, is another way of saying that.
Great question. So I think that it's more pronounced in kids with special needs, right? Executive dysfunction is associated with traumatic brain injury, which is one of the 13 categories of disability, according to IDEA. So it's also very common in kids with autism, right? Executive functioning challenges present. Even though ADHD is not a category of disability, it often falls under OHI, other health impairment, or SLD, specific learning disability. So we know that executive functioning is a huge challenge for kids with special needs. It's kind of one of the primary challenges that often are why they land in special education. So like that's a pressing issue that we need to address effectively, right? But definitely everybody can benefit from executive function guidance and support. And I do think it needs to be a much more significant part of education. So much of education is focused on, reading and writing skills and rote memorization. And the problem with that is that the research shows that kids with better executive function skills, better self-regulation skills, end up basically being able to self-reflect and do better on reading and math. So if we kind of pivot away from just really, I guess you could say, like hyper-focused on reading and math skills, which are essential and help kids develop better self-regulation skills and self-awareness skills so that they can tackle challenges that they're fascinated by and interested in the education context, then all students benefit. And this is why, if you look at some of the resources I've created, one of the things I call them the Common Core Standards for Executive Functioning. And I've basically taken the model of Common Core Standards for reading and writing and created those for executive functioning. Like, what should kids be able to do executive function-wise at different age, all the way from K through high school? And I do think that, this is like my long-term vision, but we do need to have standards and expectations for kids' executive function skills. Because if we don't, then like we don't have clear, frameworks for like, should a kid be able to use a planner? Should they be able to effectively like communicate their needs to teachers or to others? Like, there's no standards around that, right? But aren't those so essential? So I do think that's one of the long-term goals, is that as a education community and as a political community, we develop standards around what executive skills kids should have at certain ages. And then once we have those standards, we can develop frameworks and goals to embed them into the education. But it's kind of like the chicken or the egg. Like, are teachers just going to do it if they're not expected to do it? Maybe some of them, but we might need to kind of rethink it a bit.
Yeah. And in my mind, this really becomes an issue of learning equity. I use that term a lot. But what we see to be true for a lot of the learning strategies we talk about on our website is that they tend to be even more effective. They're good for everybody, but they tend to be even more effective for populations that might have executive functioning deficits, right? So using them, you're not necessarily hurting anyone, but what you're doing is trying to level the playing field a little bit. And I feel like that's a huge issue when we're talking about this executive functioning skills. Is that right now you've got a group of folks who are picking up reading and writing because they have that natural self-regulation, and the rich are just going to get richer in terms of those skills and knowledge. So unless that gets addressed and you try to bring everybody up to equal, then that's going to continue to be an achievement gap between these folks. And that gap is going to get wider and wider unless it is specifically addressed. And I'm also concerned about, kiddos not terribly different than my own, who are, not everybody likes this terminology, I know, but they're like high functioning, right? So they're still in the general population classroom for the most part, but need a little bit of extra support. And I think there are a lot of folks who are right on the other side of a diagnosis, right? That they don't qualify for the diagnosis, but they do have some deficits. And again, that achievement gap is going to get bigger and bigger for them because they're not getting any training, but they're also probably not learning at the same rate as their peers. And there's a way that they could. And so to me, this is like a huge issue that we need to be paying attention to. So I've got your back, I guess.
I appreciate that. Yeah, and just to add to it, research shows that all learners benefit when curriculum and instruction is designed with the universal design principles in mind, right? Like, kids who learn around their special needs peers, like they learn better. Like it's just better for everybody. You learn other, you know, soft skills in terms of like being able to connect with people with different backgrounds, being able to break things down into, you know, chunked out pieces that everyone can learn from. So it's good for everybody to have systems in place that allow students to reach their goals and, you know, think about the small steps on the way to the larger goals. So it's definitely like you were saying, we want to address that and everyone can win. It doesn't mean we're slowing things down for the high achieving students. It just means we're addressing a key component of learning, which is like projects and goals need to be broken into chunks to make it accessible. And the kids who can, you know, fly through that, then there can be other outcomes and expectations. And that's where standards could come into place. Like, hey, if you've achieved this, you know, you can move on to this. And I talk about like, we can kind of think of a framework of like, all learners will be able to do this. Like some learners will be able, or you can flip it actually. The bottom would be like, all learners would be able to do this if it's a pyramid. Some learners will be able to do this and like a fraction of them will be able to do this. And so we want to think about like, yeah, how do we differentiate and kind of have like expectations, but also make accessibility for all potential learners, which is good for the education system because it takes the pressure off teachers to feel like they have to like figure, you know, splitting things up and having staff assign for this and this. It's important in some degrees, but really this stuff is like essential for a very diverse education community that needs kind of a better framework for learners.
I mean, it's good for our educators. It's also good for like society later on, right? You know,
yeah.
if we can bring everybody up to have these better skills, that's going to create a better workforce later on. It's mm-hmm. going to create, I mean, so the implications I think are far reaching. So like I said, you've got my back.
I do.
I was just going through some of the, so to the listeners, Sean and I went back and forth a little bit and we've got a few papers that we had pulled out, some of the research that we were looking at. And I just want to pull one out just to kind of ground some of what we're talking about. No one study is going to be perfect, or should we make giant conclusions based on it? But you mentioned the Diamond meta-analysis earlier, and we'll make sure we link that in the show notes. But there's another article that I didn't tell you I was going to talk about. So surprise. But it's Blair and Ratza. It's 2007. So like you said, it's a little bit older, but that's okay. But in this study, what they did was they took a lot of kiddos who were getting ready for kindergarten, and they were specifically from low-income homes. And then they did a bunch of different measurements of executive function for these kiddos, and then looked to see how well they performed in kindergarten, basically. And what's cool about this is in all of these different measures, I think it's that self-regulation piece that we were talking about earlier becomes critical. I mean, more so than everything else that they looked at, that self-regulation piece was accounted for unique variance in the academic outcomes for those kindergartners. So it's a correlational study, as all of these things are going to be. It's not as if they were training or anything like that in this study. But I think it just comes back to really looking at what we've been talking about, that these skills are so critical, and they're critical early and persist. Any thoughts that you have about that?
Yeah, well, I love that study. That is actually one that is included in Dr. Adele Diamond's meta-analysis. And I think that study is really important. I think for multiple reasons, you know, at a young age, but also that it showed that even, you know, the situations can be improved even in low income environments, right? Where it's like, maybe they don't have access to all the resources, but if we zone in on the thing that really matters, it can solve that educational inequity challenge to some degree, or move us in the right direction that, hey, teaching executive skills like self-regulation can overcome some of the barriers that exist because of educational inequity. So I love that study. And I think one thing to keep in mind when you think about, okay, well, then how do we embed this into our school environment for anyone who's listening is Dr. Russell Barkley, a famed researcher on ADHD, talked about executive skills are necessary at the point of performance. And the point of performance is the place and time in the individual's life where they're failing to use executive skills or failing to self-regulate. So it's not so much about teaching executive skills in a bubble, like, okay, here's how you do this cognitive training game, which, by the way, the research shows cognitive training doesn't necessarily help with executive skills because it's really isolated, right? We need to teach these skills in a way that can be generalized across different environments. Okay, I learned how to study for the test, which I applied to getting my driver's license, which I applied to applying for, you know, to become a physician or whatever it might be. We need skills that generalize. And that's where helping kids develop these skills so they can apply them at the point of performance or the situation where they are struggling is going to be the key to making them useful. And I know a lot of the work of learning scientists is how do we motivate students? Students feel motivation when they can solve a problem that was infuriating or a pain point, right? Like something they're struggling with. If they learn the missing skill and then they can apply that skill, that self-regulation, self-reflective problem-solving skill and solve the problem, they're like, oh my God, like I got through this thing that was frustrating me. That's how they develop these executive skills and then generalize them across different scenarios.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So yeah, it ties in really nicely. It's literally the blog that I had just come out recently about the science of motivation. It's that self-efficacy piece, right? Prior to that, these students are sitting there they don't know that they can do this thing. They've never been able to successfully do it, or they're usually frustrated by it. Even if they can do it, it's hard. So yes, that moment of success is huge for motivating them to persist, to do it again, and in so many ways, right? It leads to greater self-efficacy through their own previous experiences, but it's also that opportunity for an educator to say, you've done it before, I know you can do it again, right? Because they can point to that and say, you did this just yesterday, so I know that you can do this. Let's talk through it, right? So I love that. I love it so much. We are out of time. Is there anything else that we have not talked about today that you were hoping we would?
So many things, but yeah, let me, I mean, no, but in a good way, I'm like, oh, I'm really enjoying this conversation.
And I know, me too.
I love the depth of your expertise and knowledge on the topic. So it makes it so fun to talk about it. I guess one thing I always share with people before we wrap up is a good habit for students, for adults, for anybody around this topic is there's so many podcasts and so many, you know, bits of information and articles, it can become overwhelming. Like, okay, I've got to do this strategy and this strategy and this strategy. And it can become overwhelming. But one habit I recommend to people is start by helping yourself and your students, your kids, think about your one thing. So like before you go to bed at night, or, you know, when you have your students, you know, in your resource class as a special ed teacher, like, put it up as a prompt, like, hey, if you only did one thing this period or today at school or, you know, today as a professional, what would be the thing that would be the most meaningful or, you know, help you advance you towards your long-term goals? And there's real power to this line of thinking, this one thing thinking, because there was a study done where they showed the power of the domino effect, right? So like a tiny, little tiny domino can knock over a slightly larger domino. And the effect of this, if you get to like the 17th or 19th domino, if they just increase in proportion to, you know, doubling in size, you could knock over the Eiffel Tower, right? And so this just kind of framework of thinking, like, what is the one thing that will kind of like have a domino effect on moving me forward? And I think that people can generally identify this if they calm their minds, if they chill out for a second, they start to reflect or journal, they can usually figure out like, oh, I don't really need to do all this other stuff, but I definitely need to do this one thing today. So that's just a little habit I would encourage people to think about when they're trying to decide, like, what's my executive goal for the day or the year? Well, what's your one thing today?
It also relates. I love that. It relates back to that self-efficacy piece too, right? Because if you had a one thing is a reasonable goal, right? Like I can accomplish that. And if I can accomplish that today, then I can accomplish it again tomorrow. And then you keep moving in that direction. I do the same thing with my med students. So different population entirely. But related issues where they have a huge board exam, their first board exam, and they need to start prepping for it early. Like, ideally, they're thinking about that months and months in advance. But they're also currently in courses as well. So their like day-to-day life is extremely busy. So the concept of having to do this like extra piece, is it's a lot. And so I have that same conversation. What is the one thing that you can do every day, no matter how terrible that day is, you could still accomplish that one thing that would move you towards step one, which is the board exam. And sometimes that's like answer one question or like open your notes to one page and read it. And then on a day when you have more capacity, maybe you do more. But what is the one thing you for sure can accomplish? So I love that we're on the same wavelength there, and I'm doing things that are good.
Yes, I love it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Okay, well, I want to let folks know that if you're still with us, we will also include in the show notes Sean's website, which is EF Specialists. And on that website, there's lots of just free resources available for folks, lots of articles and kind of summarizing a lot of what we've talked about here today. So if you're, you know, just wanting to get some more information or you want to reach out to Sean, that's probably the best place to go. So I'll make sure that that's in the show notes, as well as links to the articles that we talked about today. And yeah, I think we're good to wrap up. So thank you again, Sean, for joining me today. I certainly learned a lot, and I'm going to be looking up some stuff on your site and walking away trying some new strategies. So thank you so much.
Yeah, it was all my pleasure, Dr. Niebel. Thank you for having me as a guest. I appreciate it.
This episode is funded by listeners like you. To support our work and gain access to exclusive content, visit our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/learningscientists.